You're listening to the Tupton Children Podcast.
So let's start with our motivation. So in weeks like this, after what happened in Orlando, then suffering is very vivid in our mind, and compassion comes quickly. But in other times of our life, when things are just kind of going along, we don't see our regular state of being as one that is unsatisfactory. We don't see taking the five aggregates under the influence of afflictions and karma as, we don't even recognize that that's our situation. And even if we say the words, it doesn't move us very much. It's like, well, life is okay, everything's going around okay. Horrible things are happening to other people, and I wish they wouldn't, but they're not going to happen to me. So that kind of ignorance and haughtiness is the opposite of Dharma, true Dharma practice, because we're not really seeing our current situation accurately. That just by having these five aggregates, we're always walking on the edge, and any slight change of circumstances plunges us could plunge us into very deep misery. On the other hand, slight changes can roar us up to what we think is true happiness, and we don't see that as unsatisfactory. We just delight in it and think it's wonderful and want more of it. So to have genuine Dharma practice, we really have to work at seeing samsara for what it is, and seeing that that is our situation. It's not that we're over here and samsara is somewhere else, but our situation is one of existing under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, and karma. And so seeing the disadvantages of that, wanting to be free of it once and for all ourselves, and then seeing that this is the situation for all beings, whether they're the victims or the perpetrators of harm, then we develop compassion and bodhicitta and the wish to lead them to liberation as well. Of course, to lead others to liberation, we have to purify our own mind and develop our own good qualities. So that's why we're listening to teachings and practicing teachings. Because if we don't do that, we may have a compassionate heart, but actually wind up creating a mess because we don't fully understand how things exist and don't fully know what to practice and abandon. So for that reason, we're listening to the teachings, or we want to meditate on them, and then put them into practice. So in thinking about the tragedy in Orlando, have any of you thought, oh, here are these people who had a particular body and mind and ego identity that they created based on that, and all of a sudden, within a few minutes, boing, all of that ended. And what happened after that? Yeah. Did you think, oh, you know, there's a body here, there's a mental continuity, you know, what kind of thoughts were going through their mind at the time they died, where is their karma leading them, and to remember that they are no longer the person that they were in this life. Yeah, the general eye is continuing, but the particular eye of this life is finished. And so, you know, what karma did they create that is ripening at the time of death and will make them attracted towards a particular body, and to take that body, generate the mental aggregates of that kind of rebirth, and then be born again in who knows what kind of life form. And most of them probably not knowing the Dharma or anything like that, who knows what kind of life form they're born into and what kind of karma they will create in that new life form. You know, will they even have access to the Dharma? Will they be born as insects or in some other kind of realm? And to just think of how this kind of thing continues to go around and around and around, you know, taking a body and mind and then dying and then being reborn and living that kind of life, wanting happiness, not wanting suffering, never succeeding in fulfilling their wish, and then dying again, being reborn again, and thinking that there's no real person in there at all. Yeah, in all this birth and death, there's no real person. There's just an appearance of a person. But that appearance of a person does experience pleasure and pain and want happiness and doesn't want to suffer. Now, so when we have things like this that happen, it's very good to try and think about the whole big picture in terms of the Dharma and what these people are experiencing in terms of the Dharma. Yeah, and not just get locked into a view of, oh, this is so awful, this is so terrible, how could it happen, and be, you know, so upset, but to really see it in the big picture, and that makes our compassion especially strong. Yeah, because if we don't do that, then we have compassion for the victims and anger for the perpetrator. But the perpetrator is under the influence of afflictions and karma, just as well as the victims are. You know? And as long as neither one of them practices the Dharma, then, you know, all of us just keep creating the cause to be the victim in some situations and the perpetrator in the others. But we never really learn from any of it. Yeah, because we're always just following the thought that thinks my happiness now, and the thought of the happiness of only this life, the eight worldly dharmas, in whatever rebirth we're born in, you know, and not even realizing that there's something wrong with the just seeking our own pleasure in this life, not even considering that there's disadvantages of doing that, but just even feeling that this is the purpose of my life, to get as much pleasure as I can, and not, you know, understanding karma, not understanding human potential. You know? So if you really go deep in your meditation, applying it to these kind of situations, then the Dharma becomes quite real, and you begin to see the situation in it from a totally different viewpoint. Which I think is quite important. So otherwise, our Dharma knowledge is at the level of our mouth. Yeah, and we don't even consider ourselves as, you know, under the influence of afflictions and karma. We just say, oh, all these poor people, how much they suffered and it's so unfair that they died. But we don't even think, well, what about me? You know, I'm under control of afflictions and karma too. And what's happening to them right now after they left this body? And what's going to happen to me after I leave this body? Yeah. And I watched one thing, the medical examiner did all the autopsies on the people. He said that it was as if time stopped because I guess he could tell from how they found the bodies or what was going on. He said there were people who were in the middle of paying their bills, you know, people in the middle of, you know, dancing, people in the middle of, you know, a conversation, people in the middle of, you know, drinking something. And boing, like that, the whole situation changed. Yeah. And, you know, how quickly things can change, how quickly death can come without any thought. You know, I'm sure none of those people woke up that morning thinking, today I'm going to die. Or even thinking, today I might die. You know, there's always the thought of, yeah, well, I'm here and I'm going to go on. And, you know. Yeah. So we can learn a lot from these kinds of things and see how deep our own ignorance is. Okay. And see that even though you might be happy in this life at one particular moment, that doesn't prevent you from being reborn in cyclic existence. You know, because you might be happy and then, you know, clearly there was some kind of very strong collective karma to have an early death. And, you know, life was gone like this. And then all those people that are together one moment, then all their mind streams get born in so many different places. And so the people that you think are you're really close to, then all of a sudden scattered throughout the different realms of samsara. With totally different bodies, taking totally different ego identities, not recognizing each other in the next life, so that somebody you're close to in one life then is your enemy the next life, and vice versa. So a lot, you know, apply the teachings and to this kind of situation to understand what's going on. And then we also see from this how important it is to purify. Yeah? Because if we have on our own mind streams karma that could ripen in a very spontaneous death like this, totally unexpected, according to what we think is expected and unexpected, you know, but it ripens like that, and are we prepared for that? And, you know, that karma could exist in our mind stream. Have we put any energy into purifying it, into really reflecting on our own negativities and having regret for them and opening them up and a determination to try and change and, you know, taking refuge, generating bodhicitta, doing some kind of remedial action? You know, do we really take this kind of thing seriously or not? Okay, and so quite a bit actually to think about here and to use to check up for ourselves and how we're living our life. And as we do that, you know, it becomes so obvious the importance of Dharma practice and the total inconsequentiality, stupidness of attachment to the happiness of this life and getting bummed out when things don't go the way we want. You know, it's just, it's so, what a waste of time and energy. Yeah. And yet we, that's what we spend our lives doing, don't we? Yeah. Just how can I get, you know, possessions and good reputation and praise and nice sensory experiences, and how can I prevent, not having the possessions I want and people thinking bad of me and getting criticized and blamed and having unpleasant, experiences. How much do we think even beyond that to something that's more longer term, more meaningful? Okay, so this kind of meditation really puts things in perspective, and it helps us let go of a lot of the things that our ignorant mind usually makes a big fuss about. Yeah. Because our ignorant mind can make a big fuss about all sorts of things, can't it? Which really have no long-term value. Okay, so we'll go on to Nagarjuna. I think we're on 278, is it? 281.
The rising of the 25 special qualities.
Okay. But 278 starts with, did we finish all of that? Oh, 278 and 279, we went through those five. Okay, let's just review them, okay? So the, what the five are, okay? So one is, here he's common benefits of amassing the two collections. So one is by respecting and practicing the Dharma, it causes the society and the world to be happier. Okay, second one is when your actions are aimed at the Dharma, then you receive endless benefits that come from listening to the teachings. And you become famous and so able to spread the Dharma. And then third, by practicing well, then you attract a following of good people. So that's when it says ministers will bow to you. So you will have good advisors. If you're an ordinary person, you have, good people around you. And then the fourth one is, the causes of death are numerous. Those that sustain life are few, and even they can cause death. So it's important to practice the Dharma. Okay, so that's the 9-point death meditation. I don't think we went through all 9 points there, did we?
We didn't want to.
Yeah. Okay, but the point is that keeping death in mind really spurs us to practice, because we see that death is definite. We don't know when it's going to happen. And at the time we die, our body, friends and relatives and possessions can't help us. Yeah, they all stay here. Our consciousness goes on alone with the imprints of the actions and thoughts and so on we've had. Remembering death, then we will always practice the Dharma, and the contentment that arises from Dharma practice will be quite abundant. Okay? And then the fifth one is, we'll be happy and satisfied by practicing like this. And because of it, we'll sleep happily, awake happily, and because our inner nature will be without defects. In other words, we're not holding on to grudges, we're not having longings for this, to receive this, that, and the other thing, then even our dreams will be happy. So no nightmares. So basically what he's saying is if you practice the Dharma, not only do you create the cause for liberation and full awakening and good rebirth, but even this lifetime, there's so many benefits that come from it, whereby you will experience satisfaction and fulfillment. Okay? Then with 281, we're starting on the 25 special qualities that arise from collecting merit and wisdom. Okay? And, you know, since all the misery in the world comes from not practicing the Dharma, now that we have the opportunity to do so, we should really take it and learn what to practice, what to abandon, and then abandon the things that are counterproductive, practice the things that will lead us in the direction that we want to go in. And so this is talking about karma, you know, our actions of body, speech, mind, and then the imprints that those actions or the seeds, the having happened of those actions that are left on the mind stream or on the mere eye. Okay, so to, you know, have a good understanding of this and then live in a meaningful way. So in the following 25, and some of these 25 have more than one point in them, okay? So some of the 25 is talking about, okay, this cause, this thing, this activity is the cause of this result, is the principal cause, okay? So like saying ethical conduct is the principal cause of a good rebirth. But then other of the things, it's not really the principal cause, it's more the cooperative condition. So for example, love is a cooperative condition that enables us to accomplish our aims. Yeah. So all these things are listed as causes, but some of them are the principal cause and some are more the cooperative condition that enables that principal cause to ripen and bear fruit. Okay? So just so you don't get confused with it. Yeah, because otherwise we could have many wrong expectations. We could think, oh, generating love is the principal cause of accomplishing all of our aims, and so just generate love and not do any other practices. Okay, so it's good to be aware of this, and then we have proper expectations. So the first of the 25 practices is to adopt the Eightfold Discipline. So this first practice has 8 subpoints. Okay, let me read the verse that comes with it. Okay, actually it's 2 verses. Yeah, it's 2 verses that come with it. So 281 says, earnestly serve your parents and respect the principles of your lineage. Use your resources well, have fortitude, and be generous. Speak gently without divisiveness, and practice the discipline of truth. Again, he's talking about truth. By doing these in this one life, you will become king of the gods and be a godly king even now. Therefore, devote yourself always to this kind of dharma. So by doing these 8, you know, you become king of the gods. So in a future rebirth, you may be born as a king of the gods. You know, sometimes king of the gods can even refer to being liberated. Depends on the context. And you'll be a godly king right now. In other words, a king that, you know, is comporting themselves in the proper and beneficial way. So, okay, so these 8 are going to lead to benefits now and benefits along the path. Okay, so the first of the 8 is earnestly serve your parents. Okay, So in traditional societies, this kind of gets taken for granted. In our society, not so much. And often, sometimes, some parents want their kids to take care of them, and some parents don't want their kids to take care of them. They want to be independent. So it's going to depend vastly on the particular family. But in any case, you know, whatever help we can give our parents, especially as they age, then it's very good to do that, you know. So, you know, help them file their income tax, cook for them, wash their clothes, take care of them when they're sick, comfort them when, you know, they have to stop driving or when they can't walk as well, and, you know, all the mental things that happen with aging. So, you know, try to be kind to our parents instead of resentful or angry. And, you know, in general, regardless of our age or our parents' age, to try and be respectful to our parents. Of course, you know, most of us in our teenage years were not very respectful to our parents. Yeah. And it's kind of the in thing to do being a teenager now is to, you mostly rebel against your parents and, you know, everything your parents, well, your parents don't know anything to start with. Yeah. So, yeah. So it's not even saying anything that they say is stupid. They just don't know anything. Yeah. And then, you know, of course, being a teenager, we're almost awakened and we know almost everything. Yeah. So this kind of attitude actually creates a lot of friction and disharmony. But it's hard navigating those years when you're trying to assert yourself as an independent adult and yet you still need guidance from your parents. Yeah. So some people just like see me as an independent result. I don't want any guidance. And other people are, you know, like, oh, I'm scared of the world. Please take care of me. And don't want to be so independent. So it really depends on your child, you know. And then depending on your child, then you have to treat them in a certain way to help them grow up to be a full adult. Yeah. You know, for the children that are always afraid, if you just protect them all the time, they never grow up and learn to handle themselves. Yeah. On the other hand, the kids that are very rebellious, if you just kick them out of the house and slam the door, then when they need help, they're not going to come, you know. So you have to, you know, it's... being a parent is a challenge. Yeah? So we should have some compassion for our parents for having to put up with us and the way we have behaved towards them. Do you think? Yeah? I don't know about you, but some of the ways I behaved towards my parents were really not very good. Okay? So, you know, to try and treat our parents well, appreciate what they do. And at the same time, you know, in those years, you have to become independent, too. Okay, then the second one was respect the principles of your lineage. Okay, so lineage here could refer to your family lineage. It could refer to the, you know, your grandparents and the others who are older and respecting them. You know, because old people have a lot of wisdom. They've lived a long time. They've made a lot of mistakes. They have a lot of interesting stories to tell us that we can learn things from. So it refers to that, but principally this second point, when it says respect the principles of the lineage, it refers to offering service and respecting your principal spiritual mentor, as well as all your other spiritual mentors, as well as all of the people who are more advanced than us on the path. Okay? So, according to the Dharma, when you're junior in ordination or you're junior in Dharma experience, then you respect people who are more advanced than you in ordination or more advanced than you in Dharma experience. Yeah? Sometimes somebody may be more advanced than you in Dharma age, but your wisdom may be greater. Some, you know, there's all sorts of permutations, so it's not that Dharma age necessarily, makes somebody wiser. So that's why it's good to respect both the people who are older than us in Dharma age and the people who are wiser than us. Okay? Even if somebody isn't both of those, you respect them for whichever one they are. And so to esteem and serve our elders. And I find this very valuable, you know, when you meet elders who have practiced a long time, who have had a lot of Dharma experience. There's so much to learn from them. And it's very rewarding to be able to offer service to them and take care of them. Because you see their good qualities, and so kind of automatically you want to do something kind to them or kind for them so that we can learn from them. Yeah. So this is something that's emphasized a lot in the monastic system, but also in the bodhisattva vows. So even for lay people, to respect people who have taken the bodhisattva vows before you, you know, because they have more experience, they've kept the bodhisattva ethical guidelines, you know, a longer time. Then the third is use your resources well. Okay, so this is done by avoiding wrong livelihood. So in the case of lay people, earning your living by, you know, working in the armaments industry or pesticide industry, or having to lie and cheat in your work and so on. For monastic, it means in order to get your food, clothing, shelter, and medicine, then hinting to other people, flattering other people, putting people in a position where they can't say no, pretending to be something you're not, being very hypocritical, buttering people up by flattery, things like that. But instead, all of us should have a wholesome livelihood and not use things that are obtained by wrong livelihood. And when it says use your resources well, I think it also means to take good care of whatever things we have. Yeah, to not say, oh, well, this is old, I'll just throw it away, I can buy a new one. You know, but really try and wear things, use things until they completely break, whereby they can't be fixed or they're completely worn out. Yeah, because, you know, when we talk about the existence of the planet, yeah, we overconsume like mad, and this is the opportunity to level that out. And so, you know, we should avoid, you know, just going shopping online. Oh, that looks like something really good I could get. Oh, I never thought of that before, but thinking of it now, that would be really useful. Yeah, I think I want to get that. And then the Abbey can really use this. This isn't for me, it's for the Abbey. You know? So that kind of thing. And then also, you know, how we try and be careful when we use the car and not driving places when we don't need to go, and doubling up so that more than one person benefits from the trip, so that we aren't polluting the environment. Yeah. So, you know, really using our resources well, and recycling. know, conserving water, all these kinds of things. Okay, then the fourth one is cultivate fortitude so that you can remain even-tempered in all situations. So wouldn't that be nice to be able to be even-tempered in all situations? How many of us are even-tempered? Yeah. How many people do you know whereby you can more or less expect how they're going to be each time you meet them? You know, some people, from one day to the next, you don't know, are they going to be in a good mood or are they going to be in a bad mood? Yeah, so each day when you start out the day and start talking to them, you start out on your eggshells and you're sussing it out like, okay, are they going to snap at me or are they going to smile at me? So we need to ask ourselves if we're that kind of person that people, you know, they have no idea what to expect from us from one day to the other because we're so moody, you know, not even tempered at all. And so also with fortitude, then kind of no matter what happens, we can think clearly instead of just, you know, getting so overwhelmed by our emotions and swept away by our emotions that we say and do things that then stir up more people and stir us up more. Okay? So fortitude, the ability to bear different situations without getting whacked out about them. And it sure would be nice, wouldn't it? Because we can see ourselves how much we suffer when we're real emotional about everything somebody says or does. Yeah, we suffer a lot, don't we? Okay, then fifth one is to be generous. Yeah, so to be generous to others, so generous with our time, generous with offering service, generous with giving support, generous with possessions, generous with giving the Dharma. Okay, so by practicing all the different kinds of generosity, then we help others and we also accumulate merit. Yeah, some of us are not very generous. Yeah, somebody needs something and we think of a good reason why we're not the one to give it to them, even though we have two of what they need. Yeah, or somebody needs help with something and, you know, we don't feel like giving them the help. It's not an activity that we enjoy, so we just don't offer to help. Or some of us don't like to share our time. We would much rather sit and, you know, do something that we enjoy rather than sharing our time. Or we don't want to share the Dharma because maybe somebody else might know more than we do. And then what will happen to our reputation? Yeah, so there's lots of different kinds of stinginess that we need to be on the lookout for. And to instead, you know, tap into that generous heart and then just do it. Yeah? Okay, then the sixth one is speak gently and avoid speaking harshly to others. Okay, so speak kindly, yeah, and not scold and scream and create a big fuss with other people. There may be times when you have to speak rather strongly to somebody, but make sure that you're doing it with a compassionate heart. Yeah, but in other cases, you know, I think this goes with fortitude too. You know, if we can remain even-tempered, then the way we speak to others becomes gentle. It becomes we're able to express ourselves in ways that other people can understand. Okay. Of course, that all comes from caring about what other people feel. Yeah. And when we don't have fortitude in a particular moment and our feathers are ruffled up, we don't care beans about what somebody else feels. We just care about, I want to get my way, and I want them to understand me, and I'm right. So, and how many times does that happen every day? Yeah, many, isn't it? Okay, then avoid divisiveness. Yeah, so don't make comments that divide people. Yeah, don't create disharmony where there isn't some. But, you know, telling so-and-so what somebody else said about them. Exaggerating a story or telling a story in a certain way so that somebody else will get irritated at another person. You know, kind of complaining about others' traits. They do this, they do that, it's not fair, you know, because that creates a lot of divisiveness, and then your own mind is quite painful. Okay, and so divisiveness, you know, it includes bigotry, it includes prejudice, it includes any kind of speech that is, whether it's true or whether it's exaggerated, is going to divide people and create disharmony. But especially if the speech is exaggerated and you're getting a big buzz out of creating the disharmony. I won't mention any names. But some people get a real thrill out of being outlandish and dividing people. And that is not the way of the Dharma. So we should not do that. And then 8 is practice the discipline of truth. And, this sentence didn't finish. Okay. And, you know, and act according to truth. I'm finding all sorts of errors in the manuscript. Does it have, somebody else has a copy of the manuscript, that point, practice the discipline of truth. What does it say after that? And act again. But that doesn't make much sense, does it?
I have, once again, Nagarjuna reminds of the importance of speaking truthfully and acting with integrity.
Okay, you have that. Okay. Okay. So, So this Eightfold Discipline are general guidelines for how to live a good life on a daily basis. And so by practicing them, we'll be happier now. We create the cause for good rebirth. And it's the basis for being able to progress spiritually. Yeah, because you can see with any of these qualities, if we have them, you know, it sets the basis for, I mean, we create a lot of merit and it sets the basis for being able to gain deeper Dharma wisdom. Whereas if we possess the opposite and use divisive speech and disrespecting the people who are worthy of respect and so on, then it's basically self-sabotage, and we're the person who is most hurt from it. Okay, then 283 to 285. Let me just look here. Yeah. Okay. Giving the food of 300 stew pots every day, 3 times a day, cannot compare to even part of the merit of just a short moment of love. Even if not liberated, you will attain these 8 excellent qualities from practicing love. So here are the 8. Celestial and human beings will love you, and they will also protect you. You will have peace of mind and much happiness, and not be harmed by either poisons or weapons. You will effortlessly attain your aims and be reborn in the realm of Brahma. Okay, so all of that together, all those 8 benefits of cultivating love, They're the second of the 25. Okay. So, here he's talking about, you know, giving the food of 300 stew pots every day. So I think Venerable Sultram is going to be busy. You know, she likes cooking stew. yeah. So, benefits of giving 300 people pots of stew morning, you know, noon and
when do you practice it lunch?
Yeah. Your cooking is your practice. Okay. So you create so much merit, you know, by offering stew. Venerable Yeshe will offer chocolate chip cookies 3 times a day to, you know, everybody. So, you know, you have what's nourishing and then you have what you like. no, I'm joking. So, you know, you create so much merit by offering food, especially to people who are hungry. But that merit of doing this for, you know, eons, offering this kind of food, is minuscule compared to cultivating love, even for a short period of time. Okay? So it sounds weird, you know. We might think, wait a minute. You cultivate love for a short period of time, you're just sitting on your cushion. Nobody benefits from that. If you give the stew pots, you know, then somebody gets something to eat. The hungry gets something to eat, and it really helps them right then and there. So isn't that wiser than generating love? Yeah, that's the kind of thought that comes in our mind, isn't it? You know, because... okay, so the idea here is if you're giving the food, but your motivation isn't very clear, you may create abundant merit from providing food, but, you know, your motivation may be, who knows, you know, to alleviate the guilt of yourself having food. Or it may be, you know, so that other people notice how generous you are. Or it may be just, you know, a motivation of kindness. I want people to have the food that they need. You know, they need to live. Okay? So that creates a lot of good karma. But that alone is not going to get sentient beings out of samsara. Okay, so, yeah, so Khunsa Rinpoche says, giving food, wonderful though it is limited because the amount of food and the number of beings receiving it are finite. So you have 300 beings, you have 300 pots of Venerable Sultram's delicious stew, yeah, but it's limited to that, okay? Whereas when we cultivate love, we're encompassing all living beings. Yeah, so the merit is immeasurable. And also by cultivating love, we're really actively transforming our mind such that it will result in actions of body and speech that are far more generous than if we do those same actions without cultivating love. Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? So it's very important as we cultivate our good motivations to see that, you know, the importance of the motivation, not just how the action looks on the outside. Okay? I remember one time, I should look sometime in my files. It's probably buried under who knows what. But many years ago, Lama Zopa wrote me a letter. And what was the situation? I think it was when I was getting transferred out of Singapore or something like that. Anyway, he was saying that Mother Teresa creates such wonderful karma by helping the poor people who are dying and are alone and distraught with nobody to support them as they're dying. And so he really praised what Mother Teresa is doing. And then he said, but teaching the Dharma is of far greater benefit. You know, teaching the Dharma with a good motivation helps to liberate people from samsara. Yeah. So it was really quite astounding, you know, when, because you usually think of somebody like Mother Teresa and think, I could never be like her. Yeah. But then, you know, when he's saying, but you know, being able to learn the Dharma and share the Dharma with somebody else is of even greater benefit. Okay, so cultivating love is so important because it expands the mind, especially we're talking about immeasurable love. We're not talking about romantic love here. Yeah, we're not talking about parental love. We're not talking about love of money. We're talking about, you know, wishing others to have happiness and its causes in an equal way, no matter who those people are, no matter how they treat us, whether they like us or don't like us, whether we agree about gun control or don't, whether we, you know, are ISIS or anti-ISIS, whether, you know, all these kinds of things don't matter, but the heart that simply wants someone to have happiness in its causes. And of course, in wanting them to have happiness in its causes, we want them to be free of the suffering of, you know, all the self-sabotaging actions that they do. Okay, so it's not like, may ISIS have all the bombs they want so that they're happy. No, that's not love. That's not generosity. It's, you know, may those people who are so tied up in hatred be free of their hatred and be able to open their hearts to other living beings with respect and kindness and love. Okay? So then the eight benefits from cultivating love. So you'll see these in other texts, but this is the source of them. I believe, although I wonder, there might be a sutra. I think there's a sutra source to them, maybe in the Pali Canon. I should check. But usually in the Tibetans, they usually quote Nagarjuna here. Okay, so first of the eight benefits of cultivating love, celestial and human beings will like you, and you will have good relationships with others. Makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah? If you have love, then you're kind, you're pleasant, you have good vibes. So people are attracted to you. They want to be with you. You have good relationships with them. Yeah. And we can really see that in some of our teachers, can't we? You know, you can tell that they've really cultivated love because just the whole way they are around others is quite remarkable. Okay, second benefit is non-humans will not harm you and will protect you. So non-humans could refer to animals, it could refer to different spirits or whatever. Yeah, but when you have a loving-kind attitude, then even if somebody starts out wanting to harm you, they're bowled over by your kind attitude. Okay? So there's the story of the Buddha and his dear cousin, who was always competing with him, Devadatta, who unleashed a wild elephant with the thought that the elephant would charge the Buddha and trample him and kill him. And indeed, the elephant charged the Buddha. But as he approached the Buddha, he was so overwhelmed by the Buddha's vibe of loving kindness that they say the elephant kneeled down and bowed to the Buddha, okay, instead of harming him. So I don't know how much elephants do that. I mean, maybe they were trained to do that, or this was a particularly smart elephant, but you can see, you know, animals are attracted especially to people who have a lot of kindness. And they say when, like in the thought training teachings, they say when somebody is being harmed by non-human beings, then if you do the taking and giving meditation, thinking of taking on the pain of those non-human beings and then with love giving them happiness and being generous to them, that is one of the best ways to deal with those kind of hindrances, okay? So rather than doing lots of wrathful pujas and, as they say, beating drums and playing cymbals, you know, they always give the example of somebody who sat there and just meditated on taking and giving with love and compassion and alleviated the suffering of the somebody had through a non-human being. Okay, then third is you will have happiness and peace of mind free from inner turmoil. So that makes a lot of sense too, doesn't it? When you have an attitude of love, when you see others as lovable and you have affection towards them, then your own mind is happy. You have peace of mind because you're not always jealous. You're not always picking faults at other people. You know, you're just relating to them with love. You're wanting the best for them. And then, you know, your own mind is free of turmoil of, you know, they have more than me, or they don't like me, or, you know, all this other stuff our mind gets into. You know, because when you're focused with a loving attitude, there's no space for all that other kind of projection and grumbling and stuff. Okay, then fourth, your health will improve and you will experience more physical pleasure. So, you know, there's probably some scientific studies that show that when you have an attitude of loving kindness, you know, your health improves. Because you can see, you know, when you're really angry, yeah? I mean, I remember one time I was vacuuming the floor and I was so angry. I can't even remember what I was angry right now at, but I was... And then I stopped and I said, Chudran, you're going to get hurt if you vacuum the floor like that. You know? So if you're angry, you aren't aware of what you're doing, you get an accident, you get injured, you know, when you're angry, your stomach is tied up, all your muscles are tight, so you don't feel good. So it's, you know, it's right there in our own experience. So if you're able to release all that and cultivate love, then your health, you know, improves. And you have, you know, more, your body feels better too. Then fifth is you won't be harmed by poisons. So I'm not quite sure how that works, you know, but it must work karmically. Like if you have a kind mind, then you're creating good karma. You're not creating the karma to be harmed by poisons. Or the next one, you won't be harmed by weapons. Okay, so this doesn't mean that if you have love, you can go around drinking rat poison and nothing's going to happen. And that you can, you know, you have an invisible armor and the bullets are going to ricochet off of you. It doesn't mean that. But I think what it means is that when you have an attitude of love, then you create more virtue. You avoid the non-virtue that's going to lead to bad health and injury and so on. And instead you create good karma, which leads you to, you know, to not be harmed by poisons and weapons, but to be safe. But also, you know, just in general, if you're a kind person, people aren't going to be so motivated to harm you, are they? You know, when you're a mean person, or you're a country that drops bombs on people all the time, then of course people are going to be motivated to harm, because they're receiving harm. But when we give kindness, then, you know, then people don't really have a reason to harm. So we're also protected in that way. Then seven, you will be able to accomplish your aims without effort. So I think, again, by having a loving mind, then things just go better in your life, don't they? Yeah? When you have to go to a store and return something, if you're nice to the salesperson, they're going to help you. If you're nasty and complaining, they're going to avoid you. Yeah, so even worldly aims, you know, we can deal with them, we can accomplish them better if we're a nice person, or if we act in a pleasant way, rather than, you know, yell and scream and be obnoxious. Okay, and then eighth, in future lives you will take rebirth in the world of Brahma. So here, Kenzo Rinpoche clarifies that Brahma doesn't always mean the god Brahma in the form realm, but here the world of Brahma can refer to taking birth as a human being or as a god, in, you know, and experiencing the pleasures of those realms. And then also sometimes the world of Brahma can refer to liberation, because there is a prayer that says, please grant me the state of Brahma, where the state of Brahma refers to liberation. Okay, then 286, if you lead others to develop bodhicitta and then make it firm, you will always have bodhicitta as stable as the king of mountains itself. That's beautiful, isn't it? Yeah, so this is the third of the 25. Okay, so generating bodhicitta is another action that creates tremendous merit, because we're talking about the collection of merit here. So we want to generate it in our own mind stream and have that aspiration to attain full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings. Then we want to share with others the method to generate bodhicitta. We want to encourage them to generate bodhicitta. We want to help their bodhicitta from degenerating, and help ourselves not to degenerate our own bodhicitta, but instead to stabilize our bodhicitta to help others stabilize theirs. Okay, so all of these kinds of things of cultivating, stabilizing, not degenerating bodhicitta in ourselves and in others, all of them create huge, enormous merit, because bodhicitta itself is for all living beings. Okay, so, he says, even if we haven't realized bodhicitta, encouraging others to generate it and teaching them methods to do so, either the seven-point cause and effect tradition, or equalizing, exchanging self for others, then even teaching others and encouraging them will create a unique cause for us to realize bodhicitta that is very, very firm. Okay, so even, you know, we may know the teachings on bodhicitta but not have actualized it, but have great admiration for bodhicitta. And just through sharing our excitement about bodhicitta with others and teaching them a little bit about it, or showing them, you know, referring them to resources, how they can create it, you know, like in the SAFE program, you know, those of you who are the SAFE tutors, you know, really encouraging people, then it helps you yourself. It creates a cause for you yourself to, you know, actualize bodhicitta. Okay, so let's pause here if there's some questions or comments or something.
Yeah.
question about the eight excellent qualities from practicing love.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole parameter of what love means.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems kind of vague. And mm-hmm. you did say immeasurable love.
Yeah, yeah. Here it's referring to immeasurable love, which means mm-hmm. equally for all sentient beings. Yeah. So.
Do you have to have that 24/7 or just
for a while? It says even for a brief moment.
Well, no, it says even for a brief moment, it's more merit than offering all those stew pots. Okay? Yeah. But I think your love has to be pretty stable to have all eight. And again, it's not a thing of you have to have this level of love and only then do you get all eight. But even if you only have this level of love, you're going to get some portion of some of the eight. So as your love increases, then also the benefit you receive from it increases. So it's not referring to, you know, I love you forever, you're the only one. You know, that's not going to give you these benefits. Okay. Questions? Yeah.
I'm just curious about this. Doing the practice of Tong Men for someone who is suffering from
spirit hindrances.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. And do you think it would also have a beneficial effect on the spirit?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's why it would stop the spirit harm.
Okay.
Because you're cultivating, your Tong Len is for the spirit.
Okay.
You know, I mean, of course you're doing it for the person who's suffering, but you're especially doing it for the spirit. And the spirit, you know, who has such strong anger, resentment, or everything, may they be free of that. And then you just extend love to them, you know. It's kind of like how sometimes there may be somebody who's like with the inmates, you know. You meet an inmate who's just really angry at the world, and you extend a little bit of kindness, and it's like they melt. Yeah? Because just a little bit of kindness for you know, for somebody who's angry because they feel the world doesn't care about them, it goes a long way.
Many years ago, it was suggested that there was a spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't know really what to do about this. And at that time we knew a priest who was a very kind person. And we asked him to come over to give us a house blessing.
Mm-hmm.
So he came and he said, you know, I don't have a clue what to do. But he just went about saying very kind things and wishing happiness and peace for whoever was around. So he had that same intuitive feeling of sending love and understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and it has an effect. His Holiness tells a similar kind of story, that one time he was in one country and they had one hotel room that had been affected by spirits, and they put him to stay in that hotel room without telling him that that was a hotel room affected by spirits. They didn't tell him until later. But of course he did his practice there, and his practice is based on bodhicitta. And after he stayed in the room, the hotel staff said that the whole energy in the room had completely changed. And that's when they told him about it.
At that point, it was for me more important to take
Okay, so how do you value if you're in a situation of either taking your care of your elderly parents or being ordained? Okay, that's going to depend completely on the individual. You can't say one way is right and one way is wrong. You know, you have to look at somebody's motivation. You have to look at where they are in their practice. Yeah, because some people, by taking care, you know, you said that this person's teacher told them to take care of their parents. It could also be not only because the parents need help, but because that particular person needed to grow up in many ways and they needed to accumulate merit. And so they needed to do that, you know. Whereas somebody else, maybe if that person was in the same situation, the teacher would say, no, don't take care of your parents, because they could see that the person would just get dragged into the family situation and get completely stuck, and it wouldn't be helpful to them or the parents. Yeah. So this kind of thing, you have to see case by case.
I am continually struck by the fact that in all of these teachings, whether you're a great king or you're an everyday normal person, that there's this whole thing about ethical discipline and generosity and fortitude and kindness. You know, I was under the impression that there's kind of for special people, you get special teachings. But he's getting the same teachings of all sentient beings, and we all have to start in the same place.
Yeah.
And the garbage is over and over again. It's just, so I keep going, this is really, really important, because it keeps coming up.
Yeah. Yeah. So it isn't like, oh, well, I must be an advanced practitioner. I don't need to think about generosity and speaking truthfully and blah, blah. No. I mean, we need to do that, and that's the foundation for having integrity and, you know, accumulating merit and doing something good with our lives.
And it's like it never stops. It's good in the beginning, the middle, and the end.
Right. Exactly.
Where to give it up because you've gone past it.
Yeah, it's not like, oh, well, I'm generous now at the beginning of the path, but then after I perfect that, I can start being stingy because I've accumulated enough good karma from generosity. You know, that's not going to work. Anything else? Should I go on for another verse? Okay, so 287. Through faith you do not take rebirths that lack freedom. Through ethical conduct you have fortunate rebirths. Through developing your understanding of emptiness, you attain non-attachment to all things. So this verse has three of the 25 points. The one is generating faith. Okay. The second is practicing ethical conduct, and the third is familiarizing yourself with emptiness. Okay, so let's go back to the first. So through creating the cause of generating faith in the Buddha Dharma Sangha and in the law of karma and its effects, then you won't take rebirth in any of the eight unfree states. You know, when we think of the precious human life, the eight unfree states, what are they?
Freedom from human
Okay, first one.
Being born
in the hell realm. Then. A hungry ghost. So you've been born as an animal. Being born is a discriminationless, discernmentless God. Okay, then being born with wrong views. Being in a barbarian country. Yeah. Without a Buddha having descended. And.
Being displeased.
Yeah.
Defective organs, yeah. Okay, so that's the eight. Okay, so by having faith in karma and its effects, then you're going to avoid the karma for those eight unfree states, and you're going to create the karma for good rebirths, okay? Okay. So here, of the three kinds of faith, you know, clear faith, aspiring faith, and convinced faith, it's talking about the latter, you know. So the faith that comes from understanding the Dharma and thereby being able to put it into practice. So this came up before, remember, when Nagarjuna was talking about the causes for higher rebirth and the highest good. So faith was the cause for higher rebirth, and there it referred to faith in karma and its effects. And then wisdom was the cause for the highest good, liberation and enlightenment, okay? So it kind of refers back to that verse that was in chapter 1. Okay, then the second, where it says, through ethical conduct you have fortunate rebirth. So through faith you don't take bad rebirth. Then through ethical conduct you have fortunate rebirth. So again, we see in the meditation on precious human life, the cause of being born as a human being is ethical conduct. Okay, so in particular, abandoning the 10 paths of non-virtue. Okay. Okay, then the third, it says, through developing your understanding of emptiness, you attain non-attachment to all things. So non-attachment means that you're eliminating all craving, and craving is often given as the example of the true origins of dukkha, the second noble truth. Okay? So through thinking about, discussing, meditating on, realizing, familiarizing yourself with emptiness, then we'll be able to gradually cut off what he says, the phenomena of the afflictive side, such as dukkha and the true origins of dukkha, the first two noble truths. And they will be gradually subdued and eliminated. And, you know, we'll also be able to accomplish the latter two truths, true cessations and true paths. Okay, so that's that verse. Okay, so faith, ethical conduct, and familiarization with emptiness. So there we can see, you know, how important it is to contemplate karma and its effects and try and act according to that, how important it is to act with ethical conduct, and especially having precepts and keeping our precepts, you know, is a very, very good way to do that, because we're constantly accumulating virtue by abandoning negativity. And then just by familiarizing ourselves with emptiness, even we don't understand things very well, you know, we reread our notes, we reread the different books on it, we become familiar with the book vocabulary, we contemplate it a little bit. Even though it's hard to understand, the process of familiarization really pays off, because it's only by familiarization that, you know, we keep planting the seeds of an understanding of emptiness in our own mind. If we don't study it, if we just say, oh, it's too hard, you know, so I'm not going to go to class, the subject's too hard, I'm not going to go, or, you know, I don't understand anything, so, you know, useless, I'm not going to even think about it, then for sure we're not, you know, familiarizing ourselves with emptiness, and we're not creating the causes to understand it. So even though we don't understand it well, and it can be very confusing, all the different tenet systems and this and that and the other thing, you know, the only way to get unconfused is by studying and habituating yourself with it. You know, if you're waiting for all of your confusion about emptiness to disappear like that, and it's like, okay, now my confusion's disappeared, now I'll listen to the teachings, now I'll think about the teachings, you're going to have to wait a really, really long time for that to happen. Yeah. The only way of getting over the confusion is just to try and engage with it. And everybody starts out not understanding it, because, you know, if we understood it, we would already have attained liberation. Yeah, so everybody starts out without understanding it. And everybody, you know, even the Buddha, you know, because he was once an ordinary being like us, yeah, he started out that way, and, you know, you just read it, you become familiar with the words, with the concepts, slowly over time you think about it some more. Yeah, you take notes, you rewrite your notes, you ask questions. And then slowly something's going to change. But if you don't do that, nothing's going to change. Yeah? And, you know, that's kind of the same thing with everything, you know. If we just say, oh, it's too hard, I'm not going to try, then, you know, why are we complaining when we don't understand it? So we have to try, and, you know, slowly something comes. And you can see that from yourself, can't you? Those of you who've been here and listened to a lot of teachings over time, there's a change each time, and you understand it a little bit more and a little bit better. And the words don't, you know, seem so far out now. You have some idea of what they mean. So that familiarization is very, very important. It's kind of like, you know, if you want to learn to ride a bicycle, you got to get on the bike. Yeah? And of course, you're going to fall off a little, you know, once in a while. Your idea is, you know, you wear a helmet and knee pads and things like that. You start out with a tricycle and then, you know, you graduate to a bicycle. But if you never get on a bike, you're never going to learn to ride one. Yeah? And so if you just say, it's too confusing, you know, then it's always going to seem like an impossible deed for you. Okay, so I think that's it. So we did through 287, we'll do 288. Start with 288 next week. Okay, so try and think about these. Put them into practice. Yeah, quite valuable and quite practical. Yeah.
May the spiritual teachers lead me on the sacred path. And all spiritual friends who practice it have long mind. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Bosan's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase.
This merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, down by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising,